Hey everyone, and welcome to They're Playing Our Song, the podcast where your song becomes our song. I'm your host, Robert Perry Cruz, and with me is my very special guest, Aaron Kane. Hi Aaron, how's it going?
Hi Rob, it's great to be here.
Oh, it's very, very nice to have you. Thank you so much for coming on the show and bringing your song. We're going to be talking today about Es ist Vibracht, the aria from Johann Sebastian Bach's Passio Secundum Johannin, or the St. John's Passion, from, well, originally, you mentioned this to me about the different versions, but the original one, it seems like, was April 7th, 1724, his original performance in Leipzig, Germany. And so Aaron, before we get started on the song, why don't you tell me and the audience about you?
Okay, well, let's see. I am one of those fools who decided that music had to be my living. And so I currently am a college professor. I teach people how to sing. That's my life here. I also teach other courses like diction. So if I say things improperly or in an unclear way, I guess you'll know how good a teacher I am. I teach things like music appreciation too, which I understood that you took in the before time as well.
Yes, increasingly a long time ago as time
goes
on. That's
true. I listened with interest to your podcast a while back on Erlkönig for Halloween time, and I thought that was a fantastic selection.
Thank you.
I'm a professional singer and teacher of singing, and I'm a smarty pants who's supposed to know about this kind of stuff, but I don't know. I think that really I'm just another guy who loves music and loves blabbing about it, so I heard there was this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm very glad that you heard about us, and I'm very glad you're here to share your knowledge. I know for me, as a guy who started a podcast and just made my friends do it, it is becoming more and more daunting as people come and want to talk about music with these fancy pedigrees, because I'm wondering at what point I'll stop keeping up and my guests will just run the show. But at least for today, hopefully you'll let me just kind of listen and enjoy and throw in some little things as we go. For this piece. So with that, why don't we get into the song? So we're going to be talking about St. John's Passion, but Aaron, you specifically wanted to talk about this aria. What is it about this section of the piece that speaks to you?
Oh gosh, well, one reason is where it falls in the whole piece. So as you say, this is part of a larger work that when it's performed, it takes about 2 hours, the St. John Passion. And it's just a telling of Christ's passion and death in about 2 hours. And it's full of a bunch of different choruses and arias for soloists. And also there's an evangelist. There's kind of a singer who's kind of like a character who narrates the whole thing. And there's a bunch of times when he sings in this sort of speech-like manner that they call recitative. And other characters have these more spoken-like bits of singing as well. So there's all different types, and it keeps going back and forth between these different movements. And this one falls essentially right when Christ dies on the cross. This is after he's spoken his last words, Es ist vollbracht, which, in English we usually call that like it is finished.
Mm-hmm.
Do you hear that a lot for his last words?
Well, and in the translation you sent me a translation, and I looked up a couple different ones, and it is accomplished.
That's right.
Kept coming up, which sounded a bit more, I think grand in terms of what, what the ending is. It's a this was meant to be. A little bit more than it is finished, which just sounds like, yep, that's my life, folks.
Different. That comes up a lot. It is accomplished, and or it is brought full. I think vollbracht in the German, I think, kind of means like sounds even more kind of grand and even more ordained. And it is finished. I mean, you finish the dishes. this speaks to something that's altogether a much larger undertaking and a much larger ordeal, and so it is just a pivotal point in a story that is full of a lot of pivotal points, but this is an amazing moment. And so right before this happens, the singer who sings the role of Jesus in this kind of musical play version of the Passion, he sings those words. You know, the narrator guy, the evangelist, says, you know, and after all these things were done, and he cried out, you know, es ist vollbracht, and he sings that, and then this aria starts. And I guess another reason I really love it is because of the instrumentation. These arias, you know, if we think of them as what they are, as they're all songs. You know, think of any popular song that you know. One of the things that really speaks to you, even if you don't really process exactly what you're hearing, is the choices of instruments. You know, what kind of guitar is being played, or is that some old Fender Rhodes piano, or is it some kind of electronic thing? And the effect of instrumentation is just, I think, never to be underestimated. I think it just gives so much to what a song is. And sometimes we don't even really know it. We can't figure it out. And we find ourselves saying, what is that? And so the first thing you hear in this song is this one instrument. So when you listen to it for the first time and you hear this string instrument, what did you think about when you heard that?
In terms of what instrument it was that I was listening to, or just sort of the sound?
Or just, I mean, in general, yeah.
I was very taken by the richness of it. I mean, I was originally surprised. And I mean, I should have expected it, knowing that it was religious music and knowing the background of it. But usually when someone says, I have a favorite classical piece, you are thinking of Beethoven. You are thinking full orchestrations, big right. sounds. And then going back and saying, well, you know, this is a religious piece. And having had some experience myself singing, we used to sing sections of Messiah way back in high school. So in college, we would sometimes do pieces, you know, various pieces or movements, you know, understanding that, well, a lot of the religious music had the various sections. It was very sparse, usually the same sort of litanies over and over, and not a lot of instrumentation throughout the whole piece. So right. when I heard this, I was really shocked at how, well, where's the rest of the orchestra? They didn't right. show up. And then I was like, what's this guy doing the cello? And then then when I was looking at the instrumentation, it was the viola de gamba.
Yeah, the viola da gamba. And that's the thing, is because at first you're thinking, is that a cello?
Well, it looks like a cello too, because it looked exactly like a cello. I'd never heard of this instrument.
Well, this instrument is key, and that's one of the reasons I also love the piece. So the viola da gamba. Now that's what the Italians call it, because it means sort of the vial. Like the English call it a vial, and maybe you've heard that once or twice. Like that, if you read like old Shakespeare or something.
My favorite activity when I'm not podcasting is,
yeah, of course, naturally. Why wouldn't you? Hey, look, you joke, but you would have totally gotten an A in my class because you called it Messiah and not the Messiah.
Oh, okay. Phew,
ain't no definite article in that title, and that's one of those things that people get wrong more than they get right. So, full marks.
Thank you.
To Mr. Terry Crews. but 10 points to Gryffindor. the word means sort of the vial of the legs. Da gamba means like on the legs. And if you see this played, because it's cello sized roughly, people who perform on this instrument balance it on their calves.
Oh, that sounds horrible. I used to play cello, and I remember you get your little donut and you'd put it on the ground, and you had the end pin go down.
Right, because if you played cello, you'll know that's a totally different ball game. Because you know, you need that end pin for leverage, kind of. You reach up high on the neck and stuff to get some of the high notes.
Yeah.
And so, well, the fingerboard wasn't as long in cellos from this time, and so there was no need for an end pin. You know, you didn't need that leverage. That came along. There was a technological innovation that came along a lot later. And so the gamba is the same way. Some people just call it a gamba for short. And you just balance it on the legs. And so that's thing one. Thing two is it's not a cello. It's much more of a bowed guitar. It's got six strings, sometimes seven. It's got frets like a guitar. A cello doesn't have frets.
Nope.
It has a flat back like a guitar. So the whole viol family, because they got big ones and small ones, they're all variations on a bowed guitar.
Huh.
So it looks kind of like a cello, but the sound quality is different. You know, it's kind of a reedier sort of sound. It sounds sadder.
Yeah, I definitely pick up on the timbre of the instrument, because I mean, I remember playing cello. It just had like the not the low bass, but it always had this nice richness that I liked. And the, yeah, this I think reedy was perfect. Just definitely that a little bit higher pitched, not too dissimilar, but enough so that, you know, knowing it's not the same instrument, it I could hear it.
Yeah, and you get that right away. So again, like even if you listen even to a lot of classical music, there's something that kind of sticks out about that instrument. Like what's going on here?
Hmm.
And another thing about that instrument is the strings, you know, are made of gut. Those are wound gut strings, and not steel like you have in modern day instruments.
Hmm.
Or like nylon you'd have on some guitar strings and things like that. So it is wound up mostly sheep gut, sometimes cow, but most strings that are made today in the style that they were made hundreds of years ago, because that's a thing, are made out of gut. And so I'm sorry for this. It's a terrible pun, but it's just, I think it's a more organic sound too.
That's the end of the show, folks.
Yeah, that's it. That's all time we got here. But no, wait, I've got slides.
No, that's all right. My wife loves puns, so if she listens to the episode, she'll very much enjoy that part.
But I think that, you know, as corny as that is, I really think you can hear that difference. There's a sort of a warmth. There's kind of a more living quality to me. You know, I'm biased because I'm super into this kind of what they call early music these days. You know,
That's the new term now. It's not classical anymore.
Well, there's like anything else, you know, there's sort of subgenres, right? You know, it's like, well, there's manga, but there's also this. This is stuff like written before 1750.
Okay.
AD, they're kind of lumping it together and calling it early music. Although that's kind of funny because, like, everything that's been written since then,
mm-hmm.
way fewer centuries than everything that was written before then. You know,
well, you say early music. If you said, well, this is an example of early religious music, I'd be thinking, what, like monk plain chant?
Exactly. I mean, that's a thousand years beforehand. You know.
Yeah.
Start the stuff that we know about that survives in any kind of written form, that starts showing up around 800.
Mm.
So that's a long way away from 1725. So to kind of put them all in the same category is a bit dopey. But people kind of divide all classical music into kind of the stuff since then and the stuff before then. But you know, I don't know. It's kind of the Wild West as far as I'm concerned, and that I don't mind that. So. Now, the instrument, I'm sorry, I can't stop talking about the instrument because Bach, you know, by the time he wrote this, people weren't playing that instrument much for anymore. It was really huge, you know, in the 16th century and in the beginning of the 17th century, but this was the beginning of the 18th century,
mm-hmm.
and it was really old fashioned, and it was used for, you know, it was kind of a touchstone for lamenting. Like if you put a viola da gamba in something, chances are it was meant to be particularly sad and particularly moving and lamenting.
Mm.
And so he was selective about when he used it. And it'd be a lot like these days. Like if you think of a really good popular song that has a cello in it, like a rock tune that has a cello in it,
mm.
or a violin or something, you notice that. It's like, oh, huh, that's kind of interesting that that's in here. It adds a particular character.
I get, when you say cello in a rock song, I think of, do you know the band Bush?
I do, yeah.
Glycerine?
Yeah.
That song, it definitely comes in, and that might have been early enough 90s that it didn't seem too hokey to be like, oh, come on, everybody, you know, I know why you put that instrument in there. You think that's adding some weight to your tune, but actually,
yeah, some gravitas. Yeah, sometimes it works, and sometimes it's like, okay, you're just trying to going for highbrow here or something.
Your butt rock band still sucks,
yes,
even though you have a cello.
Like, nice try, Striper. But yeah, so it was, even back then, it was kind of a special effect. The audience who would have heard that, a church going audience, would have said, oh yeah, okay,
I'm feeling sad now.
Yeah, I should feel this sad. So, and the other reason, kind of getting to why I love the instrument and love the piece, is that this is the piece. This piece is how I met my wife.
Oh, wow. Were you time travelers or what?
I'm not supposed to say.
Oh, it's, man, a paradox. Oh, God. Oh,
gosh. They warn you about killing your grandfather, but they don't tell you about not talking to Rob.
So how is this? I'm thinking, when would this song be played and it would be in some sort of a class or in a church? Right? I mean, those would be does this song get played in sort of like Bach revivals or in concert halls, or is it very much just around, say, Good Friday? It's pulled out in certain ceremonies, not the right word, but what am I trying to say? Services.
No, services, yeah. No, it is pulled out then, but but you're going to hear it in a concert hall also these days. I'd say almost 50-50, because you know the performance forces that you need for this is sometimes, with apologies to all of my brothers and sisters who are worship leaders and choir directors in churches, it's sometimes a little bit beyond what they can do. Okay. You know, the singers, the chorus has to be. The music's pretty demanding. The soloists, that's demanding stuff too. And if you want to do it kind of in the old style with what, you know, what they call period instruments, which are either original instruments from that long ago that are still here or reconstructions of them. I mean, that starts getting kind of specific and sometimes expensive. So you'll hear it as often as not in a concert hall or part of like a Bach festival. And so that's how it was in my case. So I was living in Los Angeles a few years back, about a decade ago, and I was a professional singer. I had a day job because that's often how it works. But it, you know, by night, instead of fighting crime, I would sing music, sometimes early stuff like this. And so some friends of mine who I'd sung with a lot also had a neat gig in the summer up in Carmel, California. Where, you know, Clint Eastwood was mayor for a while. And it's this lovely, you know, rather affluent community right there on the sea near San Francisco. And every year they have the Carmel Bach Festival. And so a lot of Bach's music is played there, but also a lot of other classical works. And so it's kind of a, you know, a festival that takes a few weeks and great musicians come from around the world. And they perform there, and audience members, you have subscriptions and stuff. And so it's kind of a big to-do, a big tradition. Okay. Now, a couple of my friends had that sweet gig. And so they'd go up the coast every summer, and they would always talk about how great it was, and it has, like, a nice reputation. So I thought, okay, I have got to get up there one of these days. And I didn't get the gig. I'd never tried out for it to be a singer in it, but I just drove up there once when I had a free weekend, you know, as a civilian.
Sure.
And so I'm up there, and one of the things that they're performing as part of this festival, when I happened to be there, was the St. John Passion. And so this was a piece that, because I was a music nerd, I was kind of supposed to already know all about this piece. Like, this is one of those things, like, if you're a film connoisseur, you know, and you've never seen Citizen Kane or something.
Okay.
You've never seen Chinatown or something like that. People are going to kind of look askance at you and say, yeah, okay, you know about movies. Fine. And so the St. John Passion, like the passions of Bach are like that. Like they're a legit work that you're supposed to kind of know all about. But I didn't. And sometimes I pretended to. I'm like, oh, yeah, I love that piece from the St. John.
So, religious, right? Jesus?
Right.
I get you.
So it's like
there's
that.
Instruments. Oh, great. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Just singing? Yeah.
That's the German stuff, right? Yeah, I'm all over. So I went up there, drove up the coast, and it was, you know, predictably glorious driving up there, and then I heard this great concert. Now, early in the concert, because it's 2 hours, I'm noticing that there is a really attractive woman with short blonde hair. Who's one of the cellists, And you know, you don't want to be a jerk, and so you don't stare at them. You're like, you know how it is with your guy, and you register attractive woman. Okay, they're there, they exist. Now I'm going to
enjoy. There's viola, there's cello. Kind of look at cello, and now I'm going to look at the violin. Oh, there's a sink, you know. But I'm coming back to the cello. Oh yeah, yeah.
That's right. He's like, okay, I have isolated attractive woman. Now I will not stare at them like a creeper.
Yep.
I will take in the concert. And so I had done that. I had kind of put her out of my mind successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get caught up in the story, you know, as the music goes on and the choruses and the solos going back and forth and telling this heart-wrenching story.
I definitely want to make sure I want to hear the details because this is a fascinating story, but can I tangent for just one second?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
not,
yeah.
Not exactly tangent, but you mentioned the story. Now, I am a horrible Christian. I don't know a ton about what goes
so
on.
So it was you who did the Crusades.
Yeah, I'm that kind of Christian. Yeah, the Crusading.
You
one.
Are a horrible Christian.
No, in terms of, you know, I understand what the Passion of the Christ is. I understand it is, you know, Jesus carrying the cross. And I was listening to this getting ready, and my children asked me about the Passion, so I had to try to explain crucifixion, which was a lot of fun. But I don't really know, when you talk about a two-hour story, What takes up the 2 hours? Because this, you know, the Esis Verbracht is near the end, correct?
It's towards the end.
I'm, you know, because he's acknowledging that his life is struggle. I mean, I think they use Kampf in the
sure
German.
Do, yeah.
It's sort of the end, so he's accepting this. But before that, is it the same as like Mel Gibson's movie, where it's just they're whipping him with thorns and all those horrible things, and it's set to music? Or
that's part of it. Like, depending on which gospel you're talking about, mm-hmm. Like John or Matthew or Mark, and they, you sort of pick up in different parts of the story. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, it'll start as early as, you know, the night before in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, when Jesus is sort of praying, Father, do I really have to do this? Mm-hmm. Which I always find really an amazing part in Christ's story. Mm-hmm. Is you see this moment of doubt and weakness, you know, and then people come and get him, and they, you know, and Judas sort of points him out and betrays him, and then mm-hmm. he gets put on trial, and Pontius Pilate talks to him, mm-hmm. And then they scourge him and all that, and so one of the reasons that it you know turns into 2 hours is because the choruses, for example, they're usually like kind of a reaction to mm-hmm. the story. And so are the arias. Like, they don't really advance the plot that much. Like, you'll get to kind of a, if the devout will forgive me for using this term, like, if you get to a plot point, you know, where, you know, Pilate speaks to him and says, hey, you better defend yourself, and Jesus doesn't say anything. And then there'll be an aria saying kind of something poetically similar, like, you know, like, why do you not say something? You know, why is this happening? And here's how I feel about it. Because, you know, Bach was a good Lutheran. And so one of the central tenets of being Lutheran was this personal relationship to the divine. You know, it wasn't about, you know, priests or, you know, they're far removed from you and you can't relate, you puny human. It's more, wow, what does this mean to me? You know, how can I relate to this? How is this story like my story? And how do I feel about it? And so it keeps checking in. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's kind of like a musical director's commentary on this story.
Okay.
And so that tends to add the minutes, too. It takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said, that evangelist character is the one who's really doing most of the heavy lifting in terms of advancing the plot.
Mm.
And different singers, like, briefly will also sing as characters. Like, there's one who is Pilate, and there's one who is Jesus, and someone who is Peter, and people like that.
Mm.
So it is
kind of like a play in the sense that this singer is going to be singing. When they are singing, that's Jesus. When this other fellow singing, that's Pilate. That's Pontius Pilate.
Right.
So it is the same. So I know the recording you sent me, and then there was that link on YouTube with the young boy alto. So
yeah.
he was Jesus. Like, he would keep
But that's the difference. All of the arias are also reactions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you didn't see in the clip that I sent you, the evangelist sort of advancing the plot. So all of these arias are personal reflections about kind of where we are in the story, and what that means.
Mm-hmm.
So this text, you know, it is accomplished. What comfort for all suffering souls! You know, the night of sorrow now reaches its final hours. The hero from Judah triumphs in his might and brings the strife to an end. That's not Jesus saying that. That's no character from the story. That's kind of, in a way, that's us saying it.
Oh, okay. So it is really. I mean, that really does have a huge reflective bent. Reading the lyrics and kind of just watching the clips and hearing the section and then the preceding section, the recitative. I did not get at all, but I guess that's the thing with early music. That's what we're using, is so much, the pieces are so big. It's a lot to take in.
Exactly. And so I don't think it's at all inappropriate to think of this like a really big album, mm-hmm. you know, and this is a track off of the album.
Okay.
And you know, one thing I miss from the days of vinyl is, you know, it's rare these days to have a band that kind of constructs their album in terms of a side one and a side two,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you can hear that transition of a part one and a part two to kind of the whole album as an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a way, this is kind of a part one and a part two. And so even though part one and part two are both made up of several different movements,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's this kind of a bunch of individual songs, but it's also a big work. So that's something I love. It's a very rich experience. If you and one thing picked right out of it could be all you really need, mm-hmm. to really find something to really love and really relate to. But there's also the whole big work wait for you as well.
Sure. Well, okay. Thank you for going on that tangent with me, but let's go back. I think you said it's about 10 years ago. Beautiful cellist. You were being kind of pervy, I think you were saying. You were staring, and it was really awkward.
Trying not to be pervy. And, you know, and so I got caught up in the story of the part where, you know, this is when Jesus is dying on the cross and saying his last words, and all of a sudden this attractive blonde woman switches instruments.
Whoa.
She puts down this cello, and she picks up this other thing that looks like a cello,
mm-hmm.
and starts playing this plaintive melody at the beginning. And it's over.
Mm-hmm.
It's over. At that point, it's done. I'm just completely captivated by this woman, and it's just it's done. Mm-hmm. It is accomplished. You know, it's all over for me. You know, I was instantly completely in love with this woman and her playing and how sensitive it was, and how beautiful it was. And the recording that I sent you, the MP3, mm-hmm. that's her. That's my wife.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's excellent.
That's a performance she did, a recording she made with the Portland Baroque Orchestra in Portland, Oregon, which is an early music ensemble. And so, you know, the recording that I sent you is a lot of people I know. A lot of people I know, and I've worked with some of them, and they're friends. And that's the woman I married. And so, I had to meet her, and we did kind of this. I met her afterwards. We had a lot of friends in common. She'd gone to music school with mm-hmm. a lot of people who I knew and were friends with in LA, and it was just kind of through dumb happenstance that we hadn't met through them earlier.
Oh.
So they introduced us, and I sent an email that I was also trying not to be pervy in, and I almost completely failed at that, but she wasn't completely scared away, and we, you know, she gigged down in LA sometimes, and so we met, and we went out for a drink one night, and mm-hmm. Kind of closed the place down, and from then on, it was like Southwest Airlines kept us in a relationship for about half a year, and then we moved up to the Pacific Northwest together, and got married, and so. So this is a watershed moment in my life, this piece.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And especially thank you for sharing, sharing the MP3 you sent me. That's really special. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's really nice how music can have that effect of just sort of, I mean, you know, we talk about the soundtrack of our lives. You literally, that is literally the soundtrack of a key moment in your life. Is this.
But everyone has them, and that's like you say, that's the beauty of it. Really, is that, you know, you don't need to be some goony professional musician nerd or something meeting another professional musician nerd. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same to whatever song comes along at that crucial moment in your life, and when you look back at that song moving forward in your life, it always takes you right there, but also to that point where it was so important, but it also resonates in different ways as you go through life. And mm-hmm. you know, that I don't know, I just who hates music, right? Mm-hmm. No one hates it. Nobody hates music. I'm not sure how much people acknowledge the importance of it as that, like you say, the soundtrack to our lives. It really is that. And that's another thing I like about the piece itself, because like the text of it is kind of triumphant, right? You know, sure. There's a lot of exclamation marks in it. Mm. Comfort, and it's accomplished, and triumph, and bringing the strife to an end. And so the composer, he could have made that all sound victorious instead of just having this little outburst of victorious up-tempo music with the full orchestra in the middle of it. You know, there's just this moment where kind of the clouds break and you hear that triumph in the music. But yeah. Then it comes back. It just stops, you know, it just stops in its tracks. And then the S is full, blah, comes back in, sort of reminding us all of like, yeah, this is good that this happened, but it's also very bad that this happened. Mm-hmm. And Bach isn't letting us forget that.
Yeah, it was surprising hearing it, because, you know, it was just very, it was very sad. You had the gamba playing, and then just to be hit with the, I guess it's the hero from Judah triumphs in his might, I think, is mm-hmm. the first, and then it brings the strife to an end. I think those are the two phrases, right, that have mm-hmm. just the boom, the big orchestration, here it is, like you said. And,
yeah, and you're thinking, okay,
and I was like, here it goes, song. now it's going
song.
In.
You hear the triumph. Yeah.
Well, anytime I think of religious music, and you know, again, I have a very narrow window, and it's sort of Messiah, and you're sort of thinking of kind of like some of the, I guess, I don't know if it's Wretched Steve, right before Glory to God, and it's sort of just like this person singing, and then boom, everybody comes in, and it's huge, huge sound, and it's Christmas and fun. And with this, I sort of expected it to have that same trajectory of, okay, this is, okay, nope, we're enjoying this, you know, Christ died for our sins, here it comes, and then, it just drops. Drops right back to the, I guess it's like the single instrument or the bass in the background, I guess, and the quiet vocals again, or the quiet singing again.
And for me, you know, listening to this, you know, also not being a particularly religious person, spoilers, for me, when that comes back, I just, the shame of it occurs to me. You know, it's just like we can't escape. You know, it's as if Jesus himself is saying, yeah, you people did this.
Oh,
you know, like this had to happen, and it's a good thing, and your sins are taken away, mm-hmm. and I knew it was going to happen, and it is fulfilled. Mm-hmm. But let's not forget that y'all did this. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's culpability. in this transformation. I mean, I think a theologian or a particularly devout Christian would have all kinds of problems with what I just said, potentially. Like, that I really don't get it, that I'm misinterpreting the story.
Well, the way you're explaining it, the way you're talking about the music is, I mean, I think that jives with the interpretation of, you've got these, you know, these are the things that are happening, and it is sad because it is the death of, regardless of your you know, your religious leanings, the death of someone who was doing good deeds.
Yes.
And but then the idea of, you know, in the context of the religious service, but this is an important part in what we are all here to celebrate. And but then when it comes down again, because it, at the end of the day, it is a sad event. It is you know, it's a world changing event. Uh-huh. And it can't be taken lightly. Like, it's triumphant, but it's not exactly happy.
It's not unhappy. You know, the duality of that, I think, is so concisely presented in this song. You know, this idea of Christ dying for our sins, and that we should all be really glad for that. And yet, you know, it's also a terrible thing at the same time. I think that, you know, pound for pound, I think that this little piece of music here that's only a couple of minutes long, I think communicates more of that story. You know, in a way, it's like a complete telling of that idea within a 2-hour telling of that idea. You know, that's how I look at it. I sort of think that, like, wow, he really, I'm fond of telling my students that, like, the most important and yet the most violated rule in all of art is know how long your idea is. It's like, you know, you might, like, have a great idea that you think is for a novel, but it's really a short story. Or conversely, like, you might make this short film, but there's so much more there. You know, why didn't you really flesh out the potential that's there? And so I think that how concise he is in telling the triumph and the tragedy of this story in this one movement, I think is really stunning.
Yeah. So, I mean, Aaron, having heard the whole piece, we've got you gave me the recitative before. Uh-huh. What comes next? I'm curious.
What comes next is really amazing. I mean, you know, surprise, surprise, Bach is good. what comes next is actually one little bit of recitative where the evangelist says, and he lowered his head and was gone.
Ooh.
Just like one, and it only takes just a couple of seconds. Und neigt das Haupt und verschied. He lowers his head and sort of then disappears. You know, his spirit leaves him. And it's very short. And then right after that is this lyrical, like, officially happy song. It's a solo for the baritone. And it's sort of interspersed with a chorale. So with these passions and with a lot of box music, the chorale is very important. It's kind of like a church hymn that everybody in the congregation would have known the words to. They would have kind of grown up with it. And Bach uses them and plugs them in all the time in his passions as kind of a placeholder. And the congregation was meant to sing at that point in the service.
Just the hoi polloi could join in?
Yeah, the hoi polloi was supposed to join in. That was sort of the idea. And it's like this thing that you all have known all your lives goes here in this story.
Oh.
And so in performances these days, you know, the choir that's up there on the stage is going to be performing it. Usually not anyone in the audience. But this chorale is kind of broken up in small chunks, and it alternates with the soloist singing, basically asking Jesus, hey, my Savior, let me ask you something. Is it really accomplished? Like, did this really happen? Is it really okay now?
Mm-hmm.
It's this wonderfully kind of sweet sort of lullaby kind of song where the substance of the text is basically, did you really take away the sins of the world? Because, you know, it feels like there's still plenty of sin. Really? You know, truly? So it's this wonderfully innocent, almost kind of childlike, gently rocking tune. So after something so sad, there's this unapologetically positive but very gentle song that comes after that. You know, you think that once something this miserable happens, we're going to hang around in misery for a good long time. But we don't. And we're pretty close to the end of the whole story, and there's a pretty sweet, optimistic tune after that, and so that's always stunning too. So yeah, that's what immediately follows it. That's also pretty stunning.
That's good. Now, I mean, digging back to my music appreciation, Bach, I sort of had always lumped Mozart and Beethoven. Oh, and Bach. They were all buddies. You know, kind of like when you think of the cavemen and the dinosaurs. They were together. You know, and then learning, like, oh no, Bach was you know, the early music. He was very much, most of his pieces were in the context of his roles as as church music director or choral director, or am I?
That's right.
Okay.
Well, both. Yeah. He kind of ran the school there in the church, but he had some other jobs and in a court here and there. But it was mostly, like you say, it was mostly sacred music, and he wrote some secular stuff, but pretty much all sacred stuff. And what really blows my mind about Bach is that, you know, we know that there is a bunch more of his music that we haven't found, and we probably never will. That I think about a third of what he wrote is just lost.
Oh, just because it wasn't considered, you know, oh, this is the big piece from Bach. It was like, oh, this is something he wrote for this service. And
exactly. Like, I need something Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was generally generally the level of posterity that a lot of it was operating under, because you know, he cranked this stuff out, and some of it was lost for other reasons. Like he wrote a whole other passion on the Gospel of Saint Mark that we know exists, but we don't know where it is, and we'll probably never find it. So that kind of blows my mind, but. It's easy to kind of lump them all together. It's like, you know, when you find out someone's from Australia and say, oh, do you know Steve? You know, it's like this association that all these composers were. But there is kind of this idea of like influence, like this idea of Bach kind of begat this, begat that, kind of this line of influence, composers influencing other composers. And so that's also weird, is that for a long time, by the time Bach died in 1750, his music was considered kind of passé, kind of stodgy, old school.
Yeah.
And he was almost completely forgotten for about 100 years or so.
Sure.
Mendelssohn, if you remember that name, he kind of, hey.
Oh, yes.
So him finding the St. John Passion, it was him finding this piece and kind of saying, wow, this is a great piece. And he arranged public performances of it, and it kind of blew people's minds. And that not only made Mendelssohn popular, but it kind of finally repopularized Bach. And so it's just kind of hard to think of that there was a time when no one really cared about his music or knew about it for a big, long chunk of time, for 100 years.
Jeez. I mean, I guess similar things happen nowadays with music, where it'll go away and then, you know, someone will
come back. Exactly.
But, I mean, that'd be just such a huge scale to kind of wrap your mind. I'm trying to think about who is an artist that everyone loves that 100 years from now, like, we'll forget for a long time, and then 100 years from now, like, I'll remember Britney Spears. Yeah, let's have a big revival. You know, who I can't think
it
of.
Could be. I mean, you know, that's that's the thing, is that, you know, I think a lot of people think that, you know, classical music is kind of inaccessible and austere and hard to enjoy in some way, but you know, it was all popular music. You know, all this stuff was popular music in its day, and yeah, like you say, it's, I always think of covers, you know, like some song will go away and then someone will do a cover of, you know, Tainted Love or whatever, and it'll come back, and you'll remember not just the song, and oh yeah, that's a great song, but you'll remember the original group. You'll look up the original group, and with this kind of music, especially with stuff written like this long ago, it's a 1001 covers, you know, in search of the original that we'll never know.
Yeah,
you know, it's all. I think that's one of the things that keep a lot of us kind of fancy art music nerds. Kind of keeps us going, is this idea that there's something to be found in here. There's 1,000 minute details that we can play with in this music, trying to get closer to what we think the composer's intent was. I listened to your podcast with Christian Morosky on the Elliot Smith podcast.
Yes,
and Christian's a guy I'm friends with. I used to live near him in LA, and now I don't, and I miss him terribly. But he said something in your podcast that really stuck with me. I think he said a couple of times, he said that it was hard for him to separate the art from the person who created it.
Yes, it was. We had a long talk about that, because it is such a strange kind of phenomenon, and I think you mentioned it so well, the idea of you're interested in this person and the work they're doing, and they don't know you. It's like this weird one-way relationship between the listener and the musician.
Yeah, and you think that you understand something about the person, and maybe on some level you do, but you don't understand everything, you know. And yet music is so intimate, and it's so personal, and everyone treats a piece of music personally. And you know, with people like Bach, it's kind of turned on its head. It's the idea that, you know, we get intimately familiar with the music, and we get more and more familiar, and we drill deeper and deeper, and we'll never really know the man. And especially, like, in Bach's case, it's kind of funny. Like, we don't have a lot of writings from him about things, about, like, how he felt about music or how he felt about stuff. Like, you know, there's no big kind of romantic letters that he wrote to anybody and where he kind of pours his heart out. But what we have in his hand is, like, him bitching about not getting paid enough. or complaining about these casks of beer that someone sent him that broke, and would you please send me some replacements for them? You know, it's all really kind of mundane, kind of clerical and kind of bureaucratic stuff. And so we don't really know, and we keep trying to approach that and approach that. And just saying that now makes me think of, gosh, ages ago when I was in undergrad, a conducting professor that I had. He was this guy, he's dead now, but he was this amazing character. He was a mean old cuss, but he was really wise and really brilliant. And he would, like, smoke unfiltered Camel menthols all the time. And he had a voice like the end of the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And he told me one time, he said, newspaper reporters sometimes ask me if I could have dinner with any of these composers, like Beethoven or Mahler or Mendelssohn, which one would I choose? And you know what I told him? I'd say, no, what? Like, what'd you tell him? Who'd you pick? And he said, none of them. Not one. None of those people could impress me. I'm already intimately familiar with the best thing those people had to offer, and anything I could find out about the person himself would be a bitter disappointment.
Oh.
And I thought, yeah, that, like harsh, first of all.
Yeah,
like,
oh, wow.
And that's maybe a little over the line, I think. But on the other hand, you know, that's what we have. We have this piece of them, and unlike music in our time, you know, things like the personalities, like, you know, the Police or like, oh, Billy Corgan, or all these people that are sort of completely knit up in their work.
Yeah.
We don't get to really know them, and it's more about, I guess, what it's always about, which is our relationship to the music itself kind of becomes that personal relationship. And you know, that's, you know, that's, I think, really at the end of the day, what speaks to us is this idea of, wow, I don't know who Bach was, but I this makes me feel a certain way, and I'm going with that. You know, and that's one of the things that I love about this music, is it's maybe because he was Lutheran, I don't know, but it's just very personal, and it makes your personal everyday feelings grand. You know, it raises the stakes of how you feel about everything from the mundane to the epic.
Sure. But this piece specifically, the St. John's Passion, you know, I know you mentioned that he, you know, certainly had a lot of, you know, cranked out a ton of music, but is the sense historically that this was an important piece to him? I know you mentioned that he revised it a few times. So there's the original 1724, which was when it was originally written. But then there were, I think, something in 1730s, 1740s again, where he had made some revisions to it. Is the sense he did that because he wasn't totally happy with it? He changed it because he was in a different church, therefore he had to change something? Is there any sense of...
Well, in this case, he did that all in the same church in Leipzig, but but yeah, that's definitely a thing. And also, it's the importance of Good Friday during Holy Week. I mean, you know, this is the main event, and so for a guy who is very devout and who was completely consumed by writing music, you know, he used to write SDG. at the bottom of all of his scores, Soli Deo Gloria, Latin for "To God Alone the Glory." Like he would do that instead of a signature of his own often. So a guy who for whom this was so important, add to that that this is, you know, this is Good Friday. This is gosh, I don't. It's. I'm sorry. Sorry, folks, but it's the Super Bowl of the church year. You know, it's just. That was sacrilegious. I'm sorry, but it's the main event, and so yeah, partly because of his personality, but also because of the importance of that time of year and this piece. He would definitely revise it for that reason.
Okay. I know, Aaron. One of the things we were emailing about was, you know, the fact that this is early music, you have so many versions of it.
Right.
And I believe the version I'm gonna make the version that you sent me, so it had your wife on the gombo. And in terms of the singer, the clip you sent me from YouTube was, you know, a boy alto, which again, one of my favorite sounds. I love just the clarity of that, you know, that vocal type. The MP3 you sent me, was that a man singing falsetto?
That is a man singing falsetto. That's
okay.
Right.
All right.
That's what they call a countertenor. Mm-hmm. And the guy's name is Matthew White, and he's a really nice guy. I've known him for a while. I also love that sound because there's kind of a slightly eerie, otherworldly quality to it. In a way, it's hopefully Matt won't hear me say this, but in a way it is not beautiful in a beautiful way, if that makes sense.
It was definitely a very different, you know, the clip on YouTube with the boy alto was very much what I would expect from religious music, from classical music. It was really clean. It was bright. It was
pure,
very
purity.
Pure. Yeah. And then
he gets to go play with a teddy bear. That's what blows my mind. Like this kid, you know,
he's like a German kid though. I don't know what they do. He probably makes shoes or eat chocolate. What do they do? I don't know.
I don't know what the clip's from, but you know, it's probably, you know, the school for boy musicians in Leipzig where Bach worked and where he taught. It's still around. You know, it's still cranking out these young singers. So if you go there today and go to his old church, you know, they'll have this whole choir full of boys singing all the voice parts, all the way up to the highest voice parts. And so, you know, they're flipping each other's pages and like picking their noses and singing these amazingly beautiful sounds. You know, and it's all part of this tradition of training. Mm-hmm. But they're still just kids. They're just boys, you know, and that blows me away. I just love that they can have this completely angelic sound.
Oh, and sure.
Like, Gunter, knock it off! You know, it's amazing. But no, so this was a countertenor in the recording that I sent, and that's you'll hear it all three ways. You'll hear this performed by a female, you know, an alto singing in her range, or a male alto or countertenor, and you'll also sometimes hear it sung by a boy alto, a prepubescent boy singer. Yeah.
So when you're listening to the piece, you know, we talked about the sound you get from the boy alto, and then a little bit of the fact the countertenor, just the kind of the eeriness of it. Is there a reason that you would have just the alto, just a female alto singing it? And does that add, detract, change? I mean, what does that do for the piece if you've heard of that version?
I this is a bit of a generalization, but you get sort of a more rich, mature sound, and there are certainly countertenors who sound rich and mature also. I mean, some of them it's hard to tell that they're not an adult woman. They're all a little different, but I think generally people looking for kind of a warmer and maybe by extension more sorrowful sound will cast a female singer in that aria. But also, you know, usually it's, you know, you'll pick a couple soloists for the whole piece, and they'll, whenever there's an alto aria, it's often the same person. And so you have to kind of think the long game too, because the alto sings more than just that aria in the whole Passion if they perform the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Aaron, I know why this is your song. You explained it very, very well. This is a very personal song. It is also a song that you, as I was gonna say music aficionado, but I think that sort of doesn't quite sum up the fact that this is your profession, is music.
But, well, I'm a professional amateur.
Oh, well, that's still better than I'm an amateur. So you're well, at least one up on me on that.
If I may be allowed to like thoroughly put my snooty professor's hat on snugly, you have to remember that the root of that word is amato, you know, to do out of love.
Oh, that's what
amateur means. It means you do.
Really?
Yes,
wow.
It means you do it because you love it, as opposed to being a professional. And so you are not giving me any kind of a slight by calling me an aficionado or by saying that I like this. Like any job, you can learn to hate anything if it's your job. And so I really hope that I am an amateur my whole professional life.
Okay. I like that. I like any word origin that gives you kind of that extra meaning to say something profound with common words. I always find that to be just a fascinating way to have.
Yeah. If you're an amateur, say it proudly. You know, it's a badge of honor as far as I'm concerned. Mm.
But this is your song because you have so many ties to it from all angles, and certainly the personal tie, you know, meeting your wife, having this flashbulb memory of the song paired with meeting your wife seeing your wife for the first time,
right.
Being creepy around your wife, I guess you were describing it, right? Or did she tease you about that still? Like,
oh yeah, okay. Absolutely. She said, after you stalked me, that doesn't set a good precedent. Guys listening out there, don't do this. Don't do this. You know, when a woman hangs up on you, she's not saying prove it, you know, she's hanging up on you because you're a creeper. So the more, you know.
Oh, but beyond that, why should it be our song? Why should this be something that, you know, I mean, I'll be honest, anytime we're talking classical music, you're talking a pretty hard sell for a lot of modern folks. So even though you're giving them a 5-minute chunk, so you're giving them a piece of the larger work. It's still classical music. What would make it our song?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's a tough question for exactly the reasons you say. I think that the bad answer to that is like, well, because it's Bach, you know, you should simply know because it's a towering masterwork of the canon.
That is that is a terrible answer. I hope.
That's a terrible answer. And so, but I think that's the answer that people expect, and so they don't even bother to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe a better answer is because it's new. And I don't mean that like it's new to you, like new to you, the listener. I think it's early music is, I think, some of the newest music out there because, you know, there's a whole movement in the last like 50 years or so to try to recreate that music as it was performed back then. And now that's kind of vain.
Mm-hmm.
Because how do we really know? But we know what the instruments were made of. We have some treatises, some writings of people at the time, and some reactions to it. We know like what pitches they tuned things to because of organs, pipe organs that survived from that time. And so this is revealing a lot about us right now, mm-hmm. that we care about that. And I find that really fascinating, is that, you know, it's a new sound. You know, people who have heard classical music and they think, oh, okay, it's a big orchestra, yawn, I'm over it. You know, you only have to listen to that gamba in the beginning of this piece to hear, like, wait, what is that? That's a sound that's new to me. Mm-hmm. And is that a dude singing that? You know, that's new to me. And I find it really thrilling that at a time when, you know, let's face it, we're pretty interested in what's new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that it's some of the newest stuff out there is the stuff that we're kind of putting together, sort of in an earnest attempt to be kind of historically informed and to approach what it might have sounded like back in that day. And it's kind of, I don't know, maybe I watch too much Indiana Jones movies or something, but that really appeals to me, that kind of search for this. If I said Raiders of the Lost Ark, would you like hang up on me?
What?
Is that beyond the pale?
No. I am super impressed with this answer, and I'll be honest, because taking something this old and coming at it from its new perspective and sort of the rebuilding, this idea of kind of rebuilding, rediscovering, reimagining, is not a tack I would ever take to try to tell someone to listen to classical music. So I'm just sort of listening. So you can use whatever cheesy descriptor you want. Right. You've earned it. You've earned it.
But I don't know. Like, there might be another answer too. Now that I think about it, because, like, okay, so if you take a piece of popular music that you love these days, I think sometimes when we approach it, we were asking ourselves, like, I love this song. I know I love this song. It really speaks to me. Mm-hmm. And I maybe can't articulate it, but I love it. And so you start wondering how good it is. You know how you do that with songs, where you start trying to kind of ask yourself, is this legit? Is this art? Do I like it because it's that good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the value? Is this just, how much is this is me, and how much of this is,
how much of it is just, this is just like, bona fide art. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, with music like what you kind of broadly define as classical, I think that's kind of a flipped question. You know, it's like, I'm told that this piece of music is art. Like, people tell me that this is art and that I should care. Mm-hmm. But is there something in this art that speaks to me and makes me love it? Mm-hmm. You know, where it's kind of that, it's that equation taken from the other way, which is, instead of, I love this, I wonder if it's art, it's more like, well, so if this is art, big deal. Do I love it? You know, is there something in here for me to love, something kind of universal that really speaks to me, instead of like, oh, well, it's a fascinating treatment of this particular text. Like, you know, at the end of the day, who cares about that?
Yeah.
It's does it speak to me? Mm-hmm. And, I love being surprised. I am moved to tears by some pretty cheesy music written in the last 50 years, you know, and I make no apologies for it. And if that's true, then by all means, I think somebody can take some of this, you know, hoity-toity music from who knows how many hundreds of years ago, and say, wow, it's really about something that simple and that personal, and what is it about that sound that makes me feel that way? You know, I think that makes it enough of a reason that it should be your song and not just some goony professor's song.
Well, Aaron, you summed that up very, very nicely. So everyone at home, now that you've heard the description, I hope that you consider Es ist Vibrach from the St. John's Passion to be our song.
Aww.
And Aaron, you had the suggestion that we should play the whole piece for the listeners.
Yes.
So I think this is a good time to do it. Through the magic of editing, you are now going to hear the whole Es ist Vibracht aria. So here it is.
Helfer führt als Sieg mit Macht. Der Helfer führt als Sieg mit Macht. Der Helfer führt als Sieg mit Macht. Und schließt den Kampf. Und schließt den Kampf. Und schließt den Kampf. Der Helfer führt als Sieg mit Macht. Der Helfer führt als Sieg mit Macht. Es ist
I hope you all enjoyed listening to the full song. Aaron, thank you so much for knowing the musicians and you told me checking with them that it was okay to play. I'd love to play all the songs for everybody, but it's nice to have some public domain because Bach ain't going to sue me at this point.
No, so. No, not exactly.
Fear I'll be haunted.
Yes. It's like, you didn't pay me enough. Where's my beer?
Oh, jeez, no. Fuck, I don't know. I got some Sam Adams in my fridge. I don't know. Is that going to be...
Oh, yeah, at least he dressed right. You know, similar wardrobes.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Aaron, thank you so very much for coming on the show and sharing a personal piece and sharing a piece that is, outside of kind of our Halloween episode, has really not been in the wheelhouse of anything we've been talking about. So really nice to get a great perspective on some different music.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And, you know, I anytime you want to geek out about music, I am at your service.
Okay, I'm writing it on the list of people who say that because, you know, when it comes around, like, no, you, I got the audio proof. Everybody heard it.
When the dry season comes, you will need to call in a favor, and I'll be happy to come running.
Oh, good. Aaron, you said you're a voice teacher. So are you accepting new students at this point? If anyone's in your area,
Have
to go to school?
Yeah, well, you know, I would be happy to charge them money to find 200 different ways a day to say open your mouth and breathe, because that's kind of what it boils down to. But don't tell anyone. There's a trade secret. It's the art of kind of exaggerated relaxation.
So you're all teaching, or do you still do performances?
Oh, I definitely still do performances, yeah. And it's still my favorite thing to do. I get to occasionally skip town and go to another city and sing some of this old timey music. It's kind of my specialty. It's like what my my advanced degree is in, is what they call historically informed performance practice, which is just sort of a way of saying, you know, how we think they did the old stuff. How we think we did the stuff written before 1750.
Excellent.
So it's I'm a nerd among nerds, just like all of us, you know. I'm a second level nerd.
Well, Aaron, thanks again so much for being on the show. For everyone out there in listening to podcast land, you can certainly, if you have not told a friend and you enjoy the show, please do. I've told all my friends and they've been on the show, so I'm out of people to tell. So if you know anybody, please let them know about the show, and let them know that we are always interested in hearing about new music. So if they just want to check us out, subscribe to us on iTunes, or whether maybe they want to send me an email at rob@playingoursong.net to see if maybe they'd like to talk about a song. You can find previews of what we're going to be talking about in the upcoming week. Go to our website at playingoursong.net. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/playingoursong.net. And you can follow me on Twitter at @playing_oursong. Well, thanks again, Aaron. It was really, really nice talking to you today. And for everybody else out there, please join us next week for another fun episode. But until then, remember, it's your song. So play it long and play it loud. Bye.
Bye.